At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
I'm comfortable getting to the point where they can push me till I pass out or they kill me or something, but I'll be damned if I quit.
Let's go.
Welcome to Citizen. We've got a special guest today, Brandon Doherty. You've got a lot going on. Former PJ, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm actually still currently a reservist. So I guess former PJ, but still kind of hanging in there on the weekends.
Great. And you run a company that I don't think a lot of people have heard of, to be honest, but you do a lot of super cool shit, Operator Solutions. But we'll get into that later. First, let's talk about how you got started in the Air Force. What was it that made you join in the first place?
Yeah, so there's probably a lot of people around my age group. I'm 40 years old that were, you know, either in high school or getting ready to graduate around the time the towers fell, and that was certainly the case for me. I was, you know, in a little podunked high school and didn't really have a lot going on. Was kind of low, you know, bottom of my class, I guess I'd say. And I had no idea what I wanted to do when I graduated. Had an older brother that joined the Marine Corps. The towers fell when I was a junior in high school. And so at that point, I decided I wanted to serve my country. And I asked my older brother, who was a Marine, you know, what I should do. And he was, you know, stuck in like some really shitty area in Kuwait or something. And he says, "Hey man, whatever you do, you know, don't join the Marine Corps." he's like, "Join the Air Force, man. I love you. You know, I want the best for you. And these Air Force guys got it made. So I joined the Air Force." So I went to the recruiter and I asked him, you know, "Hey, I'm kind of competitive. My brother's about a year and a half older than me." I said, what job do you have where, you know, I could kind of hang in there with my brother and he's not going to laugh at me?" And the recruiter told me, "Well, you can be an Air Force PJ, but, you know, you probably won't make it. So, but you could try for it." So at that point, I kind of had the goal set that I wanted to not just serve my country, but I wanted to become a PJ, start doing some research on it. And it fell right in line, you know, with my background. I was a swimmer in high school and an athlete, and so I wanted to give it a shot. So that's kind of how I got started initially and why I decided to join the military and also why I joined the Air Force to become a PJ.
For our non-Air Force audience, tell us what a PJ is.
Yeah, so pararescue man, it's interesting because a lot of people don't know what PJs are. An Air Force PJ is more than a medic. I tell people they're more like a professional problem solver. So by history, we're the team that goes in behind enemy lines and go get fighter pilots that were shot down anywhere in the world. That realistically, it's expanded to really using some of our skill sets to be able to rescue anybody in any precarious situation anywhere in the world. So, every PJ is a paramedic. They're also free fall parachutist, static line parachutist, trained in rescue, trained in you know, tactics and helicopter operations, aircraft operations. They're all combat divers. So very extensive skill set, and kind of go by the, you know, I guess I would say the mantra of, you know, we kind of do everything, but we're not really masters at any one single discipline. What I would say is that we're trained to really think outside the box and approach very precarious situations in a different way. typically operate in very small teams, very selective process to get through the pipeline. It takes most people 18 months to 3 years to get through the pipeline of schools. And once you get in, it's a pretty kick-ass job. There's only about 500 PJs in the whole world. That's why most people don't know about us. But we do fall under Air Force Special Warfare. And there's a couple different avenues you can go down, whether you go down the Air Force Special Operations Command route or you go through the traditional rescue route. I personally went through the rescue route, and it's served me pretty well throughout my career.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the more, in my opinion, one of the more interesting jobs out there because, you know, I have a lot of friends who started their service in the 90s, even in the soft community, and aside from the soft guys, most dudes didn't deploy at all. There's like some people with 82nd and 3rd ID that spent some time in the Balkans, I guess. And then if the guy was around long enough, maybe Gulf One or something like that, but that person would be getting ready to get out by now, or would have been out for some time by now. But PJs are an MOS that even before the GWAT were pretty, I mean, you expect to go somewhere on a semi-regular basis, one, because of the mission, and then two, because like you said, there's not that many of them. There's 500 now, but I don't think there were 500 in the 90s. I think it was quite a bit less, like 300, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so I joined in 02, and when I came in, I actually was under AFSOC initially, and there was maybe 300, you know, PJs out there. Only a handful of bases that we really operate out of. And like I said, we typically operate out of really small teams, so there's not a lot of us. But it's kind of the hidden secret in the military, honestly, because you get paid really well. You get all the special duty pays, and they, you know, throw a lot of big reenlistment bonuses at you and stuff like that to keep you in because they've invested a lot of money in you. And it's been a really tough selection to get you all the way, you know, to the point where you actually graduate. But you also get like the most kick-ass TDYs, and so it turns out to be pretty cool, and you're always kind of in the action. So the unique thing, I guess, about PJs is that you never really get to plan what the mission is. Now, there are some teams that you can attach to, like I'm sure you maybe have worked with some PJs that are attached to, you know, some of the assaulter teams, and they can pre-plan their missions. But for a guy like me who's, you know, traditional rescue, I'm kind of just sitting alert and waiting for something bad to happen, and then you just have to react to it. So it's pretty exciting, but you're never really fighting on your terms. You're kind of fighting on the enemy's terms, and you're going in with limited information, and you just got to figure it out on the fly, and make something reckless happen. And you know, we live by the motto that others may live, so constantly putting ourselves out there and just trying to bring our warfighters home.
Yeah, I mean, it's that others may live is the core mantra, the motto, I suppose, of PJs. I just talked to CZ about this a couple weeks ago. It's one of the few career fields. It may be the only one, actually. I don't know for sure about this, but it may be the only one where you're both in the fight, exposed to violence on a regular basis, but also the entire job is kind of based around service to your peers in one way or another. I guess you could say that the line medic and infantry platoons and shit like that is similar. But you know, that's like day-to-day maintenance. You're part of the unit there, right? You're working with the same guys every day. PJs are, it's like the ultimate quick reaction force, right? But when shit goes completely sideways, and I wonder if there isn't something in the pipeline, because it is the pipeline for AFSOC and Special Forces and some of these other groups, as opposed to like regular infantry or airborne infantry like I was, is the duration of the training, right? So it's more on the British model of infantry training or the IDF model of infantry training, which is where you have a full year of training before you ever go to your unit, and then there's more training before you ever deploy. So I wonder if there isn't, from your experience, if there wasn't something about, I don't know how any of this works. I'm curious. I know there's a peer review process in a lot of selections. Is there something like that in the PJ pipeline or in the AFSOC pipeline? And what part does the selflessness play? Like being a legit team member? Because there's some, like, if you go to tier one selection, it isn't necessarily all about teamwork. Some of it's just about your individual capability and stuff like that. And then, you know, when it's tier two stuff, a lot of time it is about more focused on the teamwork and stuff. I wonder what it was for you guys.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and one I've not really thought too much about. But now that you bring it up, I can reflect back on several instances. To put it in context, I was an 18-year-old punk kid when I joined. I had no clue what I was getting into, and I did all the research in the world. But at the end of the day, the resources that we had back in, you know, early 2000s when I was looking into PJs there wasn't as much info as there is today, right? So I wasn't able to really find a mentor or somebody who was. I've never talked to a PJ until I actually graduated Indoc, or, you know, going through Indoc with our instructors. So I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I just knew I had some basic stuff that you could Google search on, how many push-ups and your runs and swims and stuff like that. But I didn't really know what was involved. So I showed up and I was like bottom of my class, man. I had a dude in my roommate was actually a force recon guy that had already been through scuba school. And he was like, hey man, if you stick with me, I'm going to get you through this. And we had like 130 people to start out. We also had another guy in our class that was like a ranger. And we had some other guys that cross trained into pararescue. And, as we started losing guys, they told me at the beginning, they said, look around. And roughly 10% of you are going to be here at the end. And that's been the, 90% attrition is kind of what it was back then. I think it might have grown up to maybe 75% attrition now, but it's still pretty high attrition. So I was looking around and, I was like, okay, 130 people, that means 13 people are going to make it at the end. And this dude's a, college swimmer, and this dude's a recon guy, he's definitely going to make it. This guy's a ranger, he's definitely going to make it. And this guy, I started going through the list and I was somewhere around like 50 or 60 where it's like, these guys are all going to make it before me. And I had no clue, what I was getting into. So I just kind of took the mindset of well, you know what? I'm comfortable getting to the point where they can push me till I pass out or they kill me or something, but I'll be damned if I quit. And so that was kind of my mindset going into it. And then I tried to just be the gray man, tried to stay quiet and, just kind of put my head down and go. But there was absolutely peer reviews along the way. Luckily, I kind of snuck through there because I was pretty quiet and I just kind of, was meeting the standards. As you progress in, further on into the different training and you start to lose people, you get down to maybe, 30 or 40 people, then you really start to hone in and they put a little more attention on the individuals. But it wasn't until you graduated Indoc in our class, I think we had, in the low 20s. So we were actually a bigger class than some of the previous classes. But it wasn't until we graduated the end of our apprentice course, which is for me, it was almost 3 years into it. And we were down to 9 at that point. We basically, it was almost weighted much more heavily on peer reviews and how you were as a teammate, you didn't have the ability just to kind of blend in anymore at that point. And so, and we lost a lot of people along the way for various reasons, but yeah, I think what they're really, we did a lot of assessments, which I thought was very interesting. We did a lot of, paper personality tests and all this stuff to kind of see what your mindset was on different things. And I didn't know if that stuff was being graded or not. We didn't really have anybody fail out because of mindset. But at the end of it, it was very interesting. We had a research group pull us aside and say that, 99% of our guys are all wired the exact same way. So I don't know if it was more of a special research project to see, if we all had the same traits in common, or if it was somehow, they were, hey, who we're going to focus on and try to weed out the people with the wrong stuff. I don't really know at the end of it. I just know that, somehow I matched the right personality. And so oftentimes when I have people that will try to say, oh, you're a badass because you're a PJ, and I'm sure you get stuff like this too with your background. But I kind of tell them, no, I just think I was born wired a different way, and I was just happened to fall in to the right group to be able to get through it. And, you know, I give the credit to God for that one. Not really anything I did. I just kind of stuck in and had some grit and determination and kept my head down. And I was apparently wired the right way.
Mm, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, certainly there's something to be said for the company you keep in that regard. Being in the right spot is important. And that's a leadership thing, of course. And as far as the badass thing goes, I don't even think today most people, if you ask them what a pararescueman or PJ is, they have no fucking clue. But you can, there's some examples at least, right? Like, we've seen them in movies for years, but it was never, I don't think it was ever really made obvious who they were, what they were doing. Like, Black Hawk Down, people sawing dudes out of a Apache or Black Hawk, what do you call it? The pilot seats and shit. And doing recovery and rescue. The guy from, God, what's the name of that stupid show? Modern Family is one of them. And then the people that yank Tom Berenger out at the end of Sniper, right? Those are pararescue men. But nobody ever talks about them because they're not Navy SEALs, right? So
yeah,
they don't write books, so there's no reason to pay attention. But it is something now with some of you guys who are more public figures. I mean, certainly with CZ being SEAC, that helped promote the career field a little bit. I wondered, so when they said that you guys are all wired the same, did you get a sense of what they meant by that?
Yeah. Well, I think it was more tied to like an alpha personality. Also, just the way we deal with conflict and the way we look at situations, and we really, I guess going back to one of my original statements of thinking outside the box and just we view problems a different way. And I did a little bit of studying in college of like, you know, different personality styles and stuff like that. And they definitely try to pull out, you know, they'll present you with a problem or a situation, and the way you view it is it kind of fits in a different lane, and everybody kind of has their own, you know, they might fill in a broader bucket. And I'm probably doing a disservice to this, but essentially PJs all kind of think in the same box, which is really kind of more outside the box, right? When something crazy goes on, instead of being very reactionary, we can kind of pull ourselves out and take a deep breath, and we don't let the chaotic situation around us define how we react. And I never really understood the reason why they were selecting for that. I guess I could come up with a million reasons why I think it's important, but I can tell you there's a couple missions that I was on where absolute chaos broke out and dudes are dying and blowing up, and I see my teammates, my PJs around me, just the way that we are able to focus when all of that crazy stuff is going on. It was like it instantly reminded me of like, okay, this is why, you know, they beat the shit out of us in the pool and they're taking our air away and they're trying to create all this chaos around us and they want us to do something, a task. It could be something very simple, you know, tying knots or doing something underwater, but they take away our air. They try to make it as chaotic as they can, but then they have us do something that's very minuscule, but it takes a lot of focus. And it really clicked for me a couple times on a few missions where I was like, oh, now I understand why that training is important, but I also understand why that's a wiring thing and not something that I can really, you know, train to.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
I can do it to some degree, I guess.
Sure, but yeah. It's being able to compartmentalize in the moment is a really important part of reacting well in a chaotic situation. And it's true of gunfights. I've been in plenty of those. It's definitely true there, so you don't make stupid mistakes. But I think it's even more true, especially true in gunfights where the gunfight is secondary to what your task is, right? Like we had a PAO that was attached to us who's carrying like a sidearm or some shit. And he's walking around in the middle of a gunfight taking pictures. I'm like, dude, you're fucking crazy. I don't know what you're thinking. But, you know, the more obvious example are medics and PJs. who are, you know, spending time collecting or triaging or treating patients in the middle of all this chaos. That's a skill, I guess, to some degree you can train that. But I also think that you have to have some innate proclivity for that sort of behavior before. I don't think you can train somebody who can't do it to do that, frankly.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And also it is, I believe now, and I need to look at, I should know this. I don't, but I believe now they're really weighting the personality test very heavily, honestly. And that may come to a shock to some folks, but it's because if they can determine, if they can in fact prove that these personalities are needed to accomplish a mission, and we can pre-select people that have a better chance of actually getting through based on these personalities, then we can save a lot of tax dollars. So, you know, and not put people through unnecessary thrash and try to get them through a program that they naturally aren't really meant to fit into, but then find something that they can do. And I know that special op or the community I come from, the special warfare, they're really trying to analyze that data and say, hey, well, you probably wouldn't make a good PJ, but you make a really good combat controller, or you'd make a really good special recon guy based on, you know, these traits. Now, I think they still let them try out, but, you know, the data suggests that their analysis are correct.
This episode is also brought to you by BlackRifleCoffee.com, the best coffee in the world. As a matter of fact, they won both the gold and bronze medal at the Golden Bean Awards this year for their exclusive coffee club entries in the elite category. So the best coffee on earth literally was Circus Bear by Black Rifle, one of their ECS. So I recommend that you go sign up for the Black Rifle Coffee Club. Use the code CITIZEN. You're going to get those points off. And, you know, you get all the benefits for being in the coffee club. You get the free shipping. You get access to all the partner deals. You get access to the exclusive coffee club. You get access to any new products that come out before anybody else does. You know, it's a very large club that they have over there. And the coffees are premium. Every single one of them is good. You're going to get experience for – you can do just the plain coffee club. And if you want your two bags of espresso or your two bags – of silencer smooth or whatever it is you drink, you can get those two bags or one bag or whatever you want every month, or rather you can use the ECS, the exclusive coffee club, and get access to some of the most premium coffees on the planet and kind of learn what it is that you like, you know what I mean? So then you can order those premium coffees from Black Rifle as well. So, and we all know they got the best branding, the best merch, and they're buddies. You know, we're all friends here. We love Black Rifle. So go to blackriflecoffee.com, sign up for the coffee club, or buy something, do whatever you want. Use the code CITIZEN, you're going to get those points off. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think that's a big part of it. And it's good that we're selecting for that, because I really don't think you can train somebody into that. And having somebody in that position who doesn't have that quality is going to get people fucked up, frankly. Probably them as well, but more likely other people. And then, you know, the one thing that we never do in the military is take care of what CZ likes to call the human weapon, right? Like, our arms room guy will fucking inspect the shit out of your weapon and make sure you don't turn it in with a piece of dust on it. But there is a lot of dust on us, you know, when we come back home, and then when we go back out and deploy again. And after the fact, I think that ability or even proclivity to compartmentalize becomes a real problem, because you carry that bullshit back into your civilian life, and you never really learn how to process all that bullshit that you went through. You know, it's like, I know this was the case for us. Call it what you want, suck it up, be a man, drive on, whatever stupid, you know, platitudes people use. But I assume it was also an issue for you guys when you got back from deployments, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think because our community is you know, I guess I would almost say desensitized to some degree. We, you know, they put us through a lot of very crazy training to try to get us prepared for that stuff, which is great. But yeah, there's no doubt that it has to take a toll, especially when you start losing friends and you start losing, you know, family members, stuff like that. I mean, it's pretty wild. And I have had a lot of friends that have really struggled hard with PTSD. And, you know, but I feel like this is a real problem with not taking care of the warfighter, but also who pays the price for that is the family members. And that's who I believe are the heroes, man, the people that kind of get left in the wake, the people that grab onto the coattails and are along for the ride. You know, the kids, the wives. I mean, my wife, you know, she spent 3 years without me as I was various locations all over the world. And that's, you know, when we were newly married, and she had to deal with that as a wife, and she never signed up for that, right? And the other part of that is, you know, like my wife had to talk to grieving spouses of buddies that were killed overseas, and she's, you know, pregnant, and she's trying to console a wife that just lost her husband overseas, and, you know, they got kids and this and that. And so, man, just the mental trauma on our family members is probably just as much, if not far greater than what we see in the service members. So I agree with you, but I believe it extends way beyond the service members and really, really into their families as well.
Sure. Yeah. And then it, you know, that eventually comes back on you too, as a provider, protector, as an alpha type, when you see that your family's struggling and there's nothing you can do about it because you're the one that's causing a lot of those issues. That's not a great thing for you, right? That's a bad trap to be set in. And we don't really give people the tools to deal with that shit. We have a little questionnaire when you get back from deployment. Hey, you're all right? Sweet. Get the fuck out of here. You know what I mean? And then when you transition out of the military, or transition from one place to another, it is, there's a lot of gaps in that process for sure. How are things for you? So you were doing Middle East deployments, and then you got this new job developing the pararescue program for NASA to recover astronauts and shit. First, tell me about that job, because that sounds really cool. And then second, explain, like, once your operational tempo in dangerous environments goes down a little bit, what's that transition like for you? Because you're still in uniform doing the job, but it's a whole different experience then.
Yeah, it's wild. I'll start back on the NASA stuff. So just to put it out there up front, I maybe couldn't spell, you know, rocket when I first got this job. I was in Tucson, and I had come off of 7 back-to-back deployments that were super rough, and it was right at the peak of the war. And my, going back to the family, my wife was the one that was like, hey, you need to take a knee and throttle back. So at that point, I was 10 years active duty. I decided I was going to join the reserves. I wanted to stay in the community. I invested a lot into it. I loved it, but I knew it was going to be a tough pill to swallow for my wife and two kids. And so at that point, I said, well, the best thing to do right now is to throttle back, but stay connected to the community. And so I became a reservist, but then I started working for a job. I was a military contractor in Arizona that was planning a large force rescue exercise called Angel Thunder. This is where we brought like 2,000 people in, and we had all the different special forces would come in and play in our play box for like sandbox for like 2 weeks, where we would basically put on a full war. And then, the only rule to playing with us, and we pay for everything, is that there had to be some personnel recovery event. And so we had, you know, FBI, DEA, we had SEALs and Rangers and everybody, you know, Marine guys, everybody was participating, to include aircraft and 25 different nations. So we planned this whole big, large scale war, and we put it on. And then, there'd be some personnel recovery events where the PJs would come in, and Air Force Rescue in general would come in and be able to help solve some of those problems. So that was a really cool job. Did that for 3 years, but we were just getting tired of Arizona. And so we wanted to get somewhere, get somewhere where we could feel the breeze of the ocean. And so we wanted to just get out of there. So I found out about a job that NASA was looking for a PJ to come on board as a government civilian and basically develop their commercial crew program for pararescue and teach the PJs how to rescue the astronauts. So I kind of told my wife as a joke, and so we're driving to church that evening, and so she actually went in, and I had a resume prepared because I was actually looking for other jobs. So I had a resume prepared. So she actually went in the system and applied for me, and it was in Patrick Air Force Base in Florida, Cocoa Beach, Florida. I mean, who doesn't go there? And so I didn't even apply. I didn't think I had a shot at the job. And but I got a call back, and I got an interview, and kind of told them who I was and what I was doing. I was helping run this exercise for the last several years, and so I had PJ experience, but I also had experience with really doing outside the box stuff and planning large exercises and logistics and creating really something almost out of nothing. And then, so that's exactly what they were looking for. So I landed this job in 2015, where I was going to develop, you know, the procedures for NASA. And again, so yeah, it's rescuing astronauts wasn't really new because we had the shuttle, but we didn't really rescue anybody out of the shuttle, you know, because it was a winged aircraft, and so they actually would bail out into the ocean. But PJs were rescuing astronauts back in Apollo, Gemini, Mercury. We hadn't actually rescued anybody out of an actual capsule since, you know, the 70s. So we had to kind of figure it all out from scratch. So my first day on the job, actually, I was driving and, you know, TLF screwed me up. And just like the military stuff goes, you know, trying to move. And so I was staying in this like shitty hotel with my two dogs and my kids up on like the sixth floor of the Hilton. And, you know, I was driving in on my first day to work. Down US 1 right along the river, and I saw something weird I'd never seen before, and it was an actual launch. I'd never seen a launch before in my whole life, a rocket launch. And so I saw a launch, and I was kind of mesmerized by it. And this was June 28, 2015. And so I was driving in. I see this thing going up. I'm like, oh, wow, that's cool. It's a rocket. And then all of a sudden, something squirrely happens. It starts, like, zigzagging through the air and then blows up. And so I go in, and I, you know, I don't know if that's normal. I mean, shit, that's to me, it just seemed like, oh, well, this is probably what happens out here. And I go in and meet my boss and start talking through everything. Like, yeah, there was a SpaceX rocket that blew up this morning. You know, they're part of the Commercial Crew Program. And oh, by the way, this is now your program. So this is your problem to try to figure out, right? So, so I started working with SpaceX and Boeing, and spent hundreds of hours out in the ocean with astronauts trying to figure out how to, you know, how to rescue them. What's unique about microgravity and working with an astronaut who's been up in space, and then also, you know, all the different hazards that are on board the spaceship, the hypergols, and all the things that will, like, kill you if you breathe them in. And so, you know, there was a team of folks. I shouldn't say me. There was about nine of us that worked in this organization. Really, really smart people, by the way. And we all had our own little specialty. Some of them were focusing on the aircraft stuff. Some of them were focusing on the medical stuff. There was another PJ, a guy named Brett Manny, incredibly smart. It was really he was working all the medical stuff. And then my job was really just to try to figure out how to integrate pararescue tactics, techniques, and procedures into that, and then help the spacecraft providers build their spaceships. This is before Boeing or SpaceX really had a finished product. So we worked a lot with them, worked a lot with Artemis, with the Orion, you know, the NASA program, and just try to help them craft a spaceship that was kind of rescue friendly, and then kind of built the playbook and had no idea what we needed. So I just took our pararescue UTC, which is unit type code, like all the crap that we take with us to war. And I just started going through line by line, and okay, yeah, we could probably use that. We could probably use this. We could probably use this. And went through line by line and eventually, you know, came up with a pretty good product of how we were going to actually rescue folks. Spent a lot of time with test agencies and, you know, airdrop and stuff and specialized equipment. Worked a lot with NASA engineers to build special rafts and stuff that we can actually survive out in the ocean. And so kind of our charge was that we can keep a critically injured astronaut alive for up to 72 hours out in the ocean without any sort of resupply. So we sent a PJ team in, and, you know, it's a long shot into orbit, right? So, and once they get into orbit, they're going around the Earth every 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's a couple thousand miles all the way up till they get to around Ireland. And but anywhere in between here and Ireland, if there's a problem with that rocket, you know, that spaceship on top, the capsule, is going to blast off and come down under parachute. And then somebody's got to get out there to get them. And I think there's this, like, false sense of security amongst some people that there's, you know, the Coast Guard is always waiting to come get you. I mean, I could tell you it'll be some cases, you know, 48 hours, 72 hours before there would even be a ship that would be able to get to you. So having a team that can parachute in and come save your ass right away is pretty valuable to NASA. And that's why they invested in that. Hence my job. Now, at the same time, I was also PJ, to answer the second part of your question. I was also a PJ and was starting to get up in, you know, a little more seniority. At this point, I think I was an E7, working my way up to E8. And eventually, you know, I'm E9, but As you start to get more senior in rank, you know, your roles on the team kind of go more into a managerial standpoint. So that's kind of the transition I was starting to make. But I was very active as a PJ reservist. I mean, I was still, you know, jumping a couple times a month, if not more, flying, you know, once or twice a week, and just trying to stay in the fight, just because it's kind of a fun thing to do. But you know, at this point in my career now, I was a lot more active back then, and I could get into, you know, I kind of had they pulled me off of status and 2018. And since then, I haven't been able to do a lot on the military side, do a lot on the civilian side. But that transition was kind of hard for me, honestly.
Yeah. You mentioned something before about, well, a couple of things. One, it's crazy to me that we didn't, for 40 years, we didn't have PJs teaching NASA how to do recovery. Like, that's kind of their specialty. That seems insane. Or at least the Coast Guard recovery people, right? Somebody had to be training them, right? You would think.
Well, what we did, we did these missions called TAU missions, and I was actually on them, where we sit alert, but we don't do anything different than we do for like a pilot, right? So it wasn't really super unique to NASA. It would be like they give you a 1-day PowerPoint class, they give you a spacesuit, and you can show them, get them out. But what you weren't dealing with was the complexities of the capsule itself. Mm. So we were trained on, you know, recovering astronauts, but this is like literally a dude floating in the ocean that you parachute in and go snatch, just like you would somebody who bailed out of an aircraft or something. The only unique thing about it was the spacesuit, which they gave us some really rudimentary training on, and then, you know, a little bit on space medicine, but it wasn't very complex. So yeah, PJ still did that, but it was not as involved as it is now, like where we actually have dudes, you know, that have to go through 2 weeks of training to actually be qualified to go and do this. It was just like a PowerPoint class and hand you a mock-up spacesuit and you go, you know, sit alert somewhere for a little while. So, but now it's much more involved, honestly.
And you said something about, well, space medicine sounds awesome. I don't know why. It just sounds like space drugs to me. But working with a guy who's been in space, they lose quite a bit of bone density up there. So I imagine you're dealing with somebody that's weaker than you might expect them to be under the conditions, right? Especially if they've been sitting out there for 72 hours waiting for you.
Yeah, so this is mainly on the reentry stuff is where we worry about this. So if somebody's been up in space for a while, right, and they start to lose bone density, their neurovestibular system's all out of whack. So like if they look left too fast or something, they'll just start projectile vomiting, and it's never good when you're out in the middle of the ocean. On the way up, they're just like a normal human. On the way back, they're a lot different. You treat them like your buddy that you're prying out of the bar at 2 a.m., right? They're just like, you're trying to keep them, you're just trying to get them home, right? Sure. So you're very gentle with them. You're trying to, you know, they might be throwing up and stuff like that. And that's kind of how we talk about treating them.
Luckily we have a little bit of experience there. I don't think you need to do a training class for that.
No. Yeah. The good thing is going through school, we got a lot of training in prying our buddies out of bars at 2 a.m.
So another question I had about that is, going through that process for however many years it were there any lessons learned that made their way back to AFSOC? Like, did you learn something on that job that you could apply back to the military aspect?
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place by working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies. We keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, you see, I could see in my screen the picture of the over there, the dudes on the raft, right? So that it's called the we call it the front porch, but it's like the NASA recovery raft. So working with NASA, we had to solve the problem for somebody out at sea for a very long time, and traditionally we've just had like 20 man life rafts or the survival rafts or whatever. And you get in, it's just this nasty, soupy mess of water, and dudes are cold, and it's kind of a terrible situation. You're basically just surviving. Well, we actually created a raft that it lifts you up about 18 inches off the water, and it's rigid. So it's like one of those hard stand-up paddle boards. And it has all the ballasting systems and all this really cool stuff inside. So we're not just surviving, we can actually provide treatment to them. And so we're implementing those rafts in open ocean mass casualties. So, and you can imagine, and we had to create this raft to be able to survive anywhere in the world. So, we could literally be somewhere where the water temperature is at freezing or below freezing, and we could still keep somebody warm and safe and do medical treatment on them and not just survive. And so coming up with implementations where we can actually do open ocean mass casualty. And so that's a big deal going forward. And also that's something that, my company is looking into as well, is really there's nobody who's doing this right now. And if there was an airliner or something that went down, trying to get dudes on the X quickly and be able to provide some sort of a open ocean mass casualty is really just a, there's a false sense of security out there that we're going to go out there and do it right, because nobody's really practicing. Nobody has the tools or the techniques to be able to do something like that. And so on the military side, the military has been very interested in some of the technologies and some of the things that we've built for the NASA program that has helped out the warfighter. Another side of that is this carbon fiber dive system. Now, this is something that we never really worked with in the Air Force much. When I went through, I went through Key West, the CDQC, and we dove the Draeger, and we had some smaller, lightweight dive stuff, but we didn't really have like a carbon fiber scuba system. And throughout building this program, we realized, you're going to be out in the middle of the ocean, and we use jet skis to actually pull and to stabilize the capsule. And if you think about like a ship out in the ocean, it's just kind of moving back and forth. Well, if it's underway, then it stabilizes. Mm-hmm. So that's the easiest way to stabilize like SpaceX's Crew Dragon, because it sits really high in the water, is the best way to stabilize it if it's kind of getting crazy is to actually tow it and stabilize it. So we use jet skis to stabilize it. Well, riding on a jet ski out in the middle of the ocean, big waves and stuff, you don't want freaking scuba tanks on your back, man. That's going to kill somebody. And then also now you got to get off the, and the reason you're wearing this is because all of the hypergols on board the spaceship, if you breathe them in, they're, they literally will kill you. And so you got to have full PPE on, and full enclosed self-contained breathing apparatus, right? And so basically, also when you get there, you don't want something heavy on your back, but when you get to the capsule, you got to climb in and pull four humans out, right? So you also don't want heavy ass scuba tanks on your back. So we actually worked with Interspiro, started using a carbon fiber dive system that's low profile and works out really well. And they actually got it on the approved for Navy use, the ANU or whatever that stands for now, but the ANU. And so the military can use it for any sort of operations. And so, so some of the stuff we've developed has really helped out our brothers and sisters overseas. And then also on that note, we also came up with new ways with our helicopters to be able to fit patients in. So the way the helicopters are, they kind of bow out in the middle, And so, we actually came up with these stanchions that would raise the patients up so that we can have two patients on either side and then two patients stacked underneath them. And I spent a lot of time in Afghanistan where we would we would not be able to fit the amount of people in the back of the helicopter that we needed to. And so just by simply coming up with this system that we were using for NASA, we were able to send that overseas, and our guys and gals overseas were able to implement those same, you know, tactics and be able to fit more people in the helicopter. So there's quite a bit that we did that actually helped out the warfighter, believe it or not.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you're talking about like Sea King, Sea Stallion, and Blackhawks and shit like that. You would just have two.
Yeah, Blackhawks. Primarily Blackhawks are what we're using. Pavehawks, the Air Force version, are refuelable.
Okay, that's interesting. You mentioned a phrase that I am unfamiliar with. I think it's hyperballs or some shit. Is that what you said? Can you explain what that is?
Hypergalls. And really, this is what the rockets, the way the fuel works. So they'll have two different sort of fuels that when they actually connect with each other, they cause an explosion, and they cause, you know, they essentially it's what they use to as rocket fuel. Mm-hmm. So some of the different space companies will use different agents, but they're all pretty toxic. So for instance, monomethylhydrazine and nitrogen hexoxide, when those two meet, it causes an explosion, and it'll cause, you know, just a massive amount of thrust. And this is what the rockets will use to actually propel them into space. So they're called hypergols, and it's really just a class of propellants that that are used, and but they can be very toxic.
I see. So you can't, this is on what, some internal chamber of the recovery pod or some shit, or what, where is this, where are you being exposed to this stuff?
Yeah, so well, if you think about it this way, you have a rocket that's, you know, traveling incredibly fast to get to space, right, to get to orbit. So in order for a capsule at the end of that rocket to have enough thrust to blast off of that rocket and then come down under parachute, they got to have some pretty intense engines on those. So like SpaceX will have, they call them Super Draco engines that are on the side. Initially they were created to be able to use as thrusters that they can have propulsive landings. But they're used also in the escape system. So they'll fire those if there's any sort of an anomaly as they're flying up to space, and it'll actually pull the spaceship off of the rocket and far enough to where then it could come down under parachute. So it's kind of like how ejection seat in an F-16, where, you know, they pull the handles and that thing blasts off some rocket motors and it'll propel their seat out of the aircraft. Same sort of concept with these rockets. And so now the capsules with people in them are going to blast off with these big ass engines and will blast off into the middle of the ocean and come down on a parachute. So those engines, and now in a normal situation, they're not like just free flowing the gases, the hypergols, when it lands. However, there a lot of times there'll be some residue, or if there's like a stuck thruster or something like that, then it can continue to emit one or both of those gases into the into the atmosphere. So you definitely don't want to come up without some sort of breathing apparatus to check. So we actually have sensors that we'll carry with us and hazard detectors that are programmed to be able to detect those chemicals. And so one of the first things we'll do is go up and kind of sweep the capsule and make sure there's none of those thrusters or, you know, emitting any of those toxins. But we have to be on, you know, full scuba in order to do that.
Interesting. So it's good. I mean, like the public-private partnership there, kind of mutually beneficial to a large degree. And you know, I don't know if NASA is ever going to make a comeback to what it was back in the day, but certainly these private companies are interested in, for one reason or another. I mean, I'm sure there's got to be a monetary component to it. Nobody does anything for free. I don't know if they're just laying the ground for space mining or some shit, or if it's space tourism where they're trying to make money or what, but, or just like taking over government contracts for NASA. But there's definitely a lot going on there. And similarly, you've got this private for-profit company, Operator Solutions. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, the whole time, you know, the team built the program to do it for NASA, there was always this question, well, who's going to do this for private industry? Because, you know, you can't take a bunch of special operators and put them on an airplane to sit alert for you know, Britney Spears, if she wants to go to space, right? Like, you can do that for a NASA astronaut, government on government. But what happens when we start launching tourists and other space travelers and, you know, commercial astronauts up to space? All of these companies, SpaceX, Boeing, Blue Origin, there's a long list of them. I mean, there's like, you know, in the high 20s of number of companies that are developing this capability to send people into space. So who's going to actually sit alert and provide rescue to these companies? Just so happens that, you know, while we were building the program, I just kind of got interested in this. I was also going through to college to get my MBA. And so I thought, you know, hey, just as a beta test, I would just kind of put this out there as a thesis for my capstone project and my master's to see if any of these companies, if this is actually a viable business. I did it more so just as a project for school. But as the industry, you know, some of the folks that I talked to, they were all concerned about this as well. And so I saw that the demand was very high. And at that point, I just started becoming more and more interested in, well, how would I actually do this? How would I actually start a company that would do the same thing we're doing for the military on the private sector? So, yeah, I grabbed the, you know, two smartest dudes I could grab onto, a guy named Shane Smith. He's our CFO. He was also the command chief at the time of the rescue wing that I was at. And then another chief, Chris Leas, who was our COO of our company. And he was mainly the guy who I brought over to help me develop a lot of these procedures when I was working for NASA doing this stuff. And so kind of put our heads together, and we came up with a business plan and a business model, and then just, you know, decided that we would actually jump in and start this. And Axiom was our very first client. And Axiom was a company that was going to be flying on a SpaceX Crew Dragon, but they had a contract with NASA to build onto the International Space Station, and they're going to be building their modules onto the station, and then eventually the whole International Space Station, when it, you know, reaches its service life, is actually going to be deorbited, and then the Axiom Station will be up there. And so they won that contract, so they were going to start flying people to space to stay at the station in order to, you know, to start to understand this process of how it would work. And so they were the first company that was in line to need this capability. And so they talked to us, and we came up with a game plan where we would actually, you know, start a company that can provide this. And Axiom helped us out quite a bit. So, you know, we made the decision early on in dealing with Axiom that we did not want to work only for Axiom, that this was a need that the entire industry had. And if we were just to do this for one company, then it would leave a lot of people at risk. And so we came up with a very interesting business model where they would purchase the majority of the equipment up front. And then if we service any other providers, that we can actually use that equipment as long as they get a percentage of the profits from that. We could service, you know, other clients. And so that's kind of how the business started. We have since then done a lot of very interesting things, and we've ventured into some other realms beyond just doing space stuff. I mean, we're working with other companies doing very interesting things. So we're trying to figure out how we can get a force basically of military dudes and military capabilities with, you know, aircraft and you know, parachutes and all the different things you have in the military. A lot of folks take that for granted. So it was definitely a fun project trying to figure out how to solve that for the commercial industry. And then how do you get insurance for that sort of thing, which was one of our biggest obstacles. But it was started a company in 2020 officially. I didn't leave my government job until 2021. And then we supported in summer of 2021, and then we supported Axiom in the fall of 21. So it was a pretty fast transition. It wasn't very long ago that all that went down, and our company has been growing exponentially. And, you know, we've held alert for several space missions and other unique missions as well. I think we were initially called on here to talk about the Alpha 5 project, which was really interesting. I'm sure we'll get to that in a second. But everything we do, we try to give back to the community, and so and try to make the world a safer place and a better place, and just try to do our do our part as good American warfighters.
Yeah, that idea about moving things around, what that's John Pershing, right? Infantry wins battles, logistics win wars. That's a problem that we always have to solve, you know, for every generation of warfighter. That insurance thing is real, man. We've run into that with our recovery operations for U.S. SITs around the world. Whenever some bullshit goes down, we'll send people in. We got people down in Haiti right now. It's like getting aircraft or boats insured for an operation like that. Good fucking luck, buddy. It ain't happening. Yeah. Like, nobody's going to insure that. And it is what it is. You just got to eat it sometimes. But now you mentioned it. Let's get to Alpha 5. This is a crazy ass story. I mean, I was always jealous of the Australians because you can get a balloon. You can get balloon jump wings over there. And I don't know. I've never met anybody in the U.S. military that had an opportunity to do that shit. Because it's only like, I think it's only a couple of dudes up in the balloon. And there's one, there's a jump master and then the balloon operator and whomever's jumping typically, right? At least for their shit. I was always jealous of that because that would be the most ridiculous device to have on your Class A uniform. This is a big fucking hot air balloon. But tell me about this Alpha 5 thing because it's pretty wild. You guys were up there.
Yeah. So we were pretty high. I'll start with kind of a little bit of background on how Alpha 5 started. So, and I talked about our company starting with the Axiom mission. Well, there was an astronaut on there, Larry Connor, who is just an incredible human being, and he was absolutely the driver behind Alpha 5. But the story goes, it kind of takes a step back to when he was going to space. So, you know, first Axiom crew, he was the pilot, and part of their training was they were going to come through and work with us. And, we were a new company. We hadn't validated that we could actually do what we say we can do, that we can actually get, civilian C-130, load up all of the equipment. I mean, we're talking boats and jet skis and specialized equipment and make sure we have all the right shackles and releases and everything that you would actually need to be able to airdrop this stuff out in the middle of the ocean safely. And then also, you know, having a team to be able to jump out and jump to that equipment and then get that over the spaceship. So we hadn't validated yet that this could be done. In fact, even at my NASA job, we had, at this point, we had not done an end-to-end exercise where we had actually proven that we could rescue an astronaut by committing forces out of an aircraft, jumping in the ocean, pulling him out of an actual spaceship, and then getting him to the hospital. So we thought it was the right thing to do, that we could actually put on a validation exercise to prove to the world that we can do this as a commercial company. And by this point, we did have all the right things in place with insurance and aircraft and all the nitinoid logistics that we had to get done. And so when Larry and his group, the four astronauts came through our facility, part of it, we talked to them about, you know, getting ready for rescue and this and that. We had invited them to our validation exercise, which was going to happen a few months later. This was in January of 21. And Larry actually asked the question, well, who are you guys using as astronauts that are going to be in your spaceship out in the ocean? And we said, well, we're probably going to have a couple survival experts or somebody, military guys, you know, out there, and they'll be playing astronauts. And Larry was like, bullshit, you're going to use us. Which I thought was great. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, well, now I'm going to put three billionaires and a Hall of Fame astronaut in a spaceship in the middle of the ocean, and we're going to parachute to them. We're going to hoist them out and, you know, fly over. And so, like, it's funny because, like, you could see the wheels turning with the leadership at, like, Axiom and some of these other places. Like, there's no way that's going to happen. And it's really funny because it's like they kind of, you know, pulled the leadership aside and were like, I guess when you're the guy writing the check, you have a little more say in what you can and can't do, right? And so so next thing you know, we're actually preparing for having them as our survivors out in the ocean. And so we pulled off the event. We actually took it was wild because it was an actual launch going on that same day. And so we got to watch a launch go up while these guys are out in the ocean. We had an actual SpaceX capsule that SpaceX was helping participate. They put a capsule in the water. It's the same one that we use training with the NASA folks. And we had that out in the ocean. We had the actual crew inside the capsule, and then we had our guys, you know, C-130 flew in and had our command and control up and running. Everybody was talking to each other. Our guys parachuted in, opened up all the rafts and all the boats, and came in with their SCBA on the jet skis and cleared the area, opened up the hatch, pulled the crew out onto that survival raft I was telling you about. And then we had a helicopter come in that we were working with and hoisted them out of the ocean. We flew them to the hospital and dropped them off. And, it was really good for us to validate that we could actually do this. And, after that, Larry had such a blast that he actually wrote a letter to Mike Sefferdini, the CEO of Axiom, and said, hey, you know, in this whole year of training to be an astronaut, this was like the highlight of my training, and I had such a good time. And then Larry actually came to me and said, you know, hey, Brandon, you know, after they landed now, after they've been to space, they came down the day after, they were having a social, and Larry pulls me aside and starts to ask me some questions about, you know, hey, listen, I've kind of checked this box. I'm an astronaut. Hey, I've done all this stuff now, but I've always wanted to do a really high altitude jump. You think we can get a team together and pull it off? And I told him, I said, you know, hey, Larry, I've done some high altitude jumps before, and I know that, you know, the one thing I know I can do is that we can do as a company is that we can assemble the right people to make it happen. Now, you know, I'm personally not the expert in high altitude jumping, but I commit that I can get the right team together to make that happen. So that's kind of how it started. About a year and a half of train up for this. We actually, along the way, Larry was adamant, and so was my team, quite frankly, that we didn't want to just do this to be an experience. We wanted to do it for a purpose, right? And that's where we got married up with the Special Operations Warrior Foundation. And you're probably very, very familiar with their organization, right? Yep. Okay, yeah. So we did a lot of vetting, by the way. We looked into dozens and dozens of charities, and we really wanted to support you know, folks that have been to combat and are at the pointy end of the stick there. And we really wanted to make sure that we were helping raise money for an organization that was not just honorable, but was making a real difference, right? And so, and I think I told you, I'm very passionate about the families that are left behind. And I could tell you, you know, is you're probably in the same boat. What you're thinking about when you're deployed and getting shot at and all that other stuff is not really your own safety. You're thinking about your family that's back home, left in the wake. And if you were to get killed, you know, who is actually going to be the one who is mentoring your son and helping your son graduate high school and teaching him how to be a man and, you know, and treating your daughter right and what she should look for in a man and all that stuff. And just helping them through college and making sure that they're actually successful. So as we were doing all of our vetting along the way, came across Special Operations Warrior Foundation, did a lot of research and found out that they're the organization that does all of that stuff, that takes care of the children of the special operators who are killed in combat. So we partnered with them, and we built a balloon in by the way, one of the logistics we were trying to figure out how to solve is how do you get up to 35,000, which was our goal. How do we get up to 35,000 feet to do a jump? We're looking into aircraft, and there's a couple outfits that don't really have the best safety record.
And you also can't, like, you can't drive a C-130 up there and depressurize at 38,000 feet, right? I mean, there's not a whole lot of aircraft that even have that capability, so far as I know, right?
Yeah, well, so there's a couple, you know, a C-17 can do it, but that's right at their limit. C-130 can't really get that high. So you know, we're racking our brain. There's a couple European aircraft that can potentially do it. So just kind of came up with this wild idea of, hey, can we do it out of a hot air balloon? Like, you know, can we get a hot air balloon up that high? And just so happens we have a guy on my team named John Clark, who his wife, Laurel Clark, was actually one of the astronauts that was killed in the Columbia, you know, just happened. But John, he's like the world expert on space medicine. And he was actually like the medical director for the Red Bull jump and also StratX. So like, you know, Felix Baumgartner and then also Alan Eustace. Mm-hmm. So he ran all of that stuff. And so he had expertise on how to get a balloon that high, and he knew it could be done and how to do it safely. pulled in some really, really smart folks, a guy named Rob Diegues, who pararescue background, but he was doing a lot with JSOC, and he was teaching at our at one of those courses where they're teaching some of the dudes how to jump, you know, high and all that stuff. So he had a lot of experience with high altitude jumping, and then running students and people that are not, you know, jumpers by nature, how you know, to get, I guess every one of them is a jumper, but to take guys who are mediocre jumpers and make them really good jumpers. So we need somebody like that, because like myself and Chris, my other business partner, you know, we're PJs and we've done high altitude jumps, but we're not, you know, we're by no means am I like a sky hippie hanging out, you know, at the drop zone. You know, I have like all of 600 jumps, right? And you would suspect that people that do this sort of thing probably have thousands of jumps, and there's plenty of guys out there more qualified to do it than me. So we need somebody to take care of us. But then also Larry. Larry had, Larry is, he's such a badass. He has, he had like 60 jumps or 100 jumps going into this, but they were all in like the 90s. And so he hadn't jumped in years. And so he wanted to get from doing, you know, just getting back into it with very limited jumps, and then definitely not like at least my 600 jumps. A lot of them are hard-earned jumps with O2, nighttime, yeah, night vision. I mean, they're hard jumps, right? Yeah. But like not just drop zone jumps. But Larry came in completely cold, but man, he just has that drive and that tenacity and that grit. So so we had to make sure Larry was safe. And so and so Rob was putting together the program for him. And then we had another guy, Jimmy Petrolia, who's another PJ that had he actually went up to 37,000 or 38,000. He had been that high because he has the wingsuit record. So he had done the wingsuit jump, and so we needed another guy, and he was also an AFFI. Him and Rob are both AFFIs, and so we kind of grabbed those two dudes, and then me and Chris, and me and Chris were there more so for med support. We were intentionally pulling high, and we were going to land with Larry no matter where he landed, you know, and that was kind of our initial going in. But then it turned into, you know, let's get five people and let's take them up to an altitude that nobody has jumped that high as a group, and let's actually, you know, pull off a world record. So in order to do that, we built the world's largest, or the largest hot air balloon built in the U.S., and you know, put all kinds of Special Operations Warrior Foundation stuff all over it, and the Alpha 5 Project was what it was called. Larry came up with a name, Alpha being you know, the first and the best. It's, you know, and then five being the five members that were actually going to accomplish it. And so and then the project really, because it wasn't just an experience, it was actually for a purpose, which was to raise money for Special Operations Warrior Foundation. So we kind of came together with the playbook. We built the balloon, went out to Roswell, New Mexico, partnered with the school out there, New Mexico Military Institute. By the way, if any of your listeners, it's worthwhile to look into that school. Are you familiar with New Mexico Military Institute?
No.
Oh man, it's a really, really cool organization. There's like 1,000 kids there, anywhere from middle school through junior college. It's like older than the state of New Mexico, but it's a really, really cool institution. Military institution, but they take kids. It's kind of like, it's like a military prep academy. And, but they have incredible, I mean, I think they dump like $20 million a year into their facility. So it's like when you go to their campus, it's in the middle of Roswell, New Mexico, a very unassuming place, but this campus, it's like you're walking through Harvard or something. I mean, so we were trying to find a place to launch this balloon, and we needed to launch it during dark hours. So it was either the airfield or it was like this college area, this military institute with the giant stadium lights. And so we went and talked to the college, and they were on board. And so, and man, what a cool school and a bunch of cool cadre. A lot of special ops guys work there as cadre. And so they helped us out a lot. So we launched out of there, and we went up to 38,139 feet and jumped out, man. And, you know, came down in a five-man formation and then landed out in the middle of the desert. So a lot goes into it. There was like, I mean, we had an incredible O2 technician, Tad Smith. He's done a lot of these sort of things in the past. Shane Wallace, our balloon pilot, was actually, he was one of the lead engineers for Spaceship Two for Virgin. So he was a balloon pilot and he had a lot of space experience. And so he was a you know, an odd guy, but an odd fit. But I mean, just an incredible, hardworking dude that was really, really good at his craft. I mean, how do you find somebody who has like done something nobody's ever done before, right? Like, where do you find somebody to pilot your balloon to go up to 39,000 feet?
Yeah, no shit.
So I mean, you just friend of a friend of a friend, and that's how this whole team came together. So at the end of this, we had like 60 people participating. The majority of them volunteers just want to be part of this. And again, our goal was to raise $1 million for Special Operations Warrior Foundation. And it was a mission success. We did the jump and we raised the money. But I would also say that it's a worthwhile cause. Yeah, we're trying to raise $1 million, but they could use a lot more. So and put a plug in for them, man. Alpha5project.com if you want to donate, any of your listeners want to donate, very worthwhile cause. And I can give you a personal story of something they benefited, you know, a family that I've seen them actually help out that made it very, very close home to me personally. So great organization and really vouch for them. So that's how the jump went. Super cold. It's like minus 60 up there.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's 1 degree Fahrenheit colder for every 1,000 feet, right, that you go up.
But that was three, or yeah, it might be one, yeah, one or three.
Well, I think it's after 10,000 feet. Every additional 1,000 feet, it's a degree cooler, some shit like that. I don't remember exactly what the conversion is. Yeah, but it sucks, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. So we had heated garments, but what I can tell you is we launched right at sunrise, or right before sunrise. So we were coming up. It was only about 45 minutes to get up to altitude. And 45, 50 minutes to get up to altitude. Had a couple burner problems along the way. And but we were able to get up to altitude. And I can tell you, just absolutely serene, standing out over, you know, over that ramp. And there's no wind at that altitude, or, you know, there's no wind because you're in a balloon. Mm. So you're sitting up there looking at New Mexico as the sun's coming up. You can see the curvature of the earth, really. You see the curvature at that altitude. And no sound, no wind, absolutely serene and beautiful. And then, you know, able just to jump out. Then you're going almost 200 miles an hour instantly, right? So it's quite the ride.
That's pretty sweet. And you guys met your fundraising goal, which is $1 million, right?
We did meet our fundraising goal of $1 million, which great. I think we exceeded it by, you know, a few thousand dollars, but it's definitely a cause that I think it's going to be a continual contribution from me and from our company as well. It's we met our goals, but man, they could always use more, right?
And what's the website again?
Alpha5project.com. Is how you can, you know, you could see the videos from the jump and all the stuff that we've done. And we, you know, did several interviews. We're on Fox and Friends, Newsmax, Forbes, a few other things, but also it's a way to directly, you know, contribute to the Special Operations Warrior Foundation.
Sweet. Yeah, that's really cool, man. I like, That's a great organization. These videos are fucking crazy. So definitely it's alpha and the number 5project.com, by the way. You can watch the whole thing. Definitely go check it out. And we gotta get moving here. Tell everybody where they can find you and all the stuff you've got going on.
Yeah, so I'm not like a big social media guy, but you can see what's going on in our company, man. Always something cool going on with us. os-rescue.com. That's Oscar Sierra dash rescue, RESCUE.com. We do have like an Instagram and a few other things, but I don't manage that stuff. But always something cool going on. You can check out our website. It does have links to all of that. And you know, we're kind of up to something new every month, whether it's working. The cool thing about our company is that we kind of are working with everybody from, you know, SpaceX, Boeing, Sierra Space, Space Perspective, that balloon that goes up the stratosphere. We're always doing crazy tests and cool stuff with them. So that's where you can click on and learn more. And we're also, you know, providing jobs to folks with special operations background. So it's kind of unique to find somebody who can parachute out in the middle of the ocean. So, you know, there's a tab on our website to fill out the application. We also do skill bridge for military guys in transition, and we're a growing company. We hope to, you know, getting ready to build a new facility in Titusville, and going to be about $80 million facility. And so we're growing, the company's thriving. And I would also say, really it's kind of one of those stories where the risk is worth the reward, but you don't get into something like this without taking risk. And this was one of those situations where I gave up a really good government job, and so did my counterparts, you know, gave up our jobs, and we just kind of hit the I believe button, and we believed in each other. It was built on trust, and we were doing the right things for the right reasons. And man, it's really paid off. And so I believe that it's going to continue to thrive as long as we surround ourselves by good people and keep doing the right things for the right reasons.
Sweet, man. That's a great story. Glad that you were able to come on today and talk about all this. It's super fascinating, the work as it transitions from, you know, government operations into the, I guess, technically into the civilian space business now, which is nothing. That's not something I thought was going to happen ever, to be honest. But here we are, and it's super interesting. So yeah, if you guys are interested in checking out what Brandon's got going on, definitely visit those websites. And you know, if you're a special operator getting ready to get out, I know a lot of you are. Take a look at that skill bridge, especially because you get 6 months now on the back end if you're putting in your papers. So definitely check that out. Thanks for coming today, man. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir. Anytime. Thank you all for listening. This has been Citizen.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.